Lobster Johnson has a thing he says with his...
Is it this? Beware my claw, for I have come to inflict justice?
Yeah! Where'd you find it?
I'm looking it up right now. It's on a Tumblr.
It's on a Tumblr?
Yeah.
Okay.
Lobsterfist.tumblr.com. Welcome to another episode of the MacGuffin Podcast, the movie review podcast that dreams are made of. Keith Foster, co-host San Diego. What's up?
Cassidy Robinson, co-host Los Angeles. You can't ask me what's up. I have to introduce you.
Does it really annoy you that the song What's Up by Four Non Blondes never actually has the phrase what's up?
No.
It's what's going on is the refrain.
Nope.
But the song is called What's Up. It might be What's Up, parentheses, what's going on.
This is a movie review podcast, we swear. Normally, we'll get have there. Content.
We'll get there.
This week, apparently, we're light.
Yes. We're going to be talking about the new Hellboy remake by Neil Marshall. And at the end of the podcast, we're going to be reviewing the direct-to-Netflix Motley Crue biopic, The Dirt. And we got some fun stuff ahead. We got a list.
Okay, before we go on to our next segment, before we go on to the list thing, I actually have a listener letter I want to read.
Oh, damn. Okay.
That's right. I'm not forgetting this time. A few episodes ago, we did our review on Us. Hopefully, you've had a chance to watch it by now, because this letter does kind of go a little more in depth with some specifics of the movie.
Spoiler alert. This letter spoils the movie Us.
Yeah. So this is from our friend Ted Bondman in Pocatello.
Sure.
And he says, hey, Keith and Cassidy, I enjoyed the recent episode on Jordan Peele's Us, and I just wanted to say that, like you guys, the film's use of visual metaphor totally works for me. I wanted to write to champion one visual flourish in particular. The brief shot of a real spider crawling out from underneath a carving of a spider. Uh-huh. I love this shot for a couple of reasons. There is, of course, the juxtaposition between the false spider and the real one, a duality that is echoed by the tethered and Adelaide/Red in particular. The shot also contributes to the sense of tension and unease that the audience feels at the start of the film for no concrete reason, because spiders provoke an instinctual fear reaction in a lot of people. And because of that fact, because of the fact that since the spider is never dealt with in any way, the audience is troubled by an unresolved gestalt. At the end of the movie, one of the friends I saw it with remarked, "I want to know what happened to that spider!" But my favorite thing is the way I think the spider metaphor, spider metaphorically represents Red, Lupita Nyong'o's alter ego. There's a finger drumming gesture that Red makes that really reminded me of the way a spider's legs move. In fact, Red's whole modus operandi is very spidery. She's been down in the dark, planning her moves for years, a patient, arachnid-like predator. You can see this in the way she abducts Jason. She lays a trap and then patiently waits, camouflaged by the red van, and then stretches her limbs out to seize him. The way she moves in the finale, too, is quite spider-like. During her fight with Adelaide, there's no wasted movement in her quick, precise strikes, in her unnerving stillness and graceful speed. Much has been said of Nyong'o's performance in this movie, and the physical choices she makes are a huge part of that. Finally, just like Red, the spider is unfairly maligned. We regard all spiders as vermins, although the vast majority of them are totally harmless to humans, and the ones that are venomous are largely docile unless provoked. So yeah, I absolutely think there's a ton of richness in the film's visual language, and it definitely comes together for me. Thanks for a delightful listening experience as usual, and have fun at WonderCon. I guess
that's how old this letter is. Yeah. Thank you, Ted. A very, very good letter. Really keen analysis. I do not remember the spider. I'm not going to lie.
I definitely remember. And I do remember that specific shot, and I kind of share the sentiment of Ted's friend. I do remember at a certain point thinking, oh, what happened to that fucking spider? Because when they show it, like, you expect it to get squashed or something, and there's no real resolution with it.
Is it in the car when they're on their way?
No, it's in the cabin, like their summer home.
Right.
She's like laying on the couch, and there's like a fake spider on a coffee table, and the real spider like crawls out from under it.
Okay. Well, I mean, just right there, there's the imagery, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I remember just thinking, like, they get a really gross, ugly looking giant spider, like, not the kind you normally just sort of see wandering around a house, but like
right, a really... Right, not a house spider.
Yeah, like the kind that you exotic. Go, ugh, why would she not squish that?
Okay, interesting. Yeah, you know, I mean, I was probably just kind of filing that away as just like creepy horror movie imagery, and I didn't like make a point to remember it. Certainly like a valid read. When I see the movie again, because I'm sure I will, I'll take a closer look at that. But thank you, Ted. We appreciate the letter.
Yeah.
And if anybody else wants to send us any, emails about the things that we talk about on here, or our analysis of movies, or how wrong we got something, MacGuffinPod@gmail.com. Let's go into this little project that I invented. So there was a thing on film Twitter that happened a little while ago. The original tweet says, you have to pick 7 films for a marathon all-nighter, but the rules are, 1, the films must be franchise films, and 2, all 7 films must be from different franchises. So, pretty open as far as that goes, but every movie that's on these lists are from, have multiple in their series, essentially. And this is a film marathon. So I don't know how many people have ever done this, but down here in LA, there's a few of our repertory houses that will do this, usually around Halloween. There's maybe other times they do this for like different like director retrospectives or whatever. Well, they'll show 5 or 6 movies in a row with intermissions and stuff like that. They usually start in the afternoon. You go all night. People bring pillows. They go in their pajamas. And then you leave around, 7, 8 in the morning. So this is kind of that. And I thought it was a fun challenge. So, both of us answered this on Twitter. And we're going to talk about our lists and sort of why we picked the movies we picked. I'll let you go first.
You always make me go
first. Unless you want me to.
No, that's fine. I can go first.
Okay.
So we're going to start our evening off. And I have a theme to my movies, so I'm going to see if you can pick out maybe what my theme is.
Sure.
I'm going to start the evening off strong. One of Steven Spielberg's best, Jurassic Park.
A classic, well, a banger.
Yeah, it is. It's a banger. It's a good, I think, a good, solid start to the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Then... We're gonna go back in time a little bit to some probably slightly more dubious animatronics in comparison to Jurassic Park, to the 1989 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles original theatrical movie.
Sure, yeah. And that would do very well in a rep house. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. After that, we're going to follow it up with Hellboy 2, The Golden Army.
Okay.
Then from there, we're going to go to Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yes, by future Gravity and Roma director.
Alfonso Cuarón. We're going to follow that up with Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
The final in the original Star Wars trilogy. From there, we're moving on to Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2.
Okay.
And we're going to round our evening off with another Steven Spielberg, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Fitting in your placement.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's my list.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm trying to figure out like what your theme is. I'm not really pulling anything. I mean, other than they're all blockbusters for the most part.
Yeah.
They're all, you know, kind of franchisee, sort of geeky, Comic-Con friendly movies.
And there's something, there's a deeper connection between all these movies. And how did I think about it? I think every one of these probably has some kind of animatronic creature besides Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. but no, so my theme is these all movies all deal heavily with different aspects and ideas of fatherhood.
So I should have got that from the two Spielbergs.
Well, yeah, I mean, so Jurassic Park is actually, I think, one of the less heavy as far as that goes, because...
pretty in there.
But, you know... Huh?
I mean, it's pretty in there.
It's definitely in there.
Yeah.
With Alan Grant...
Yeah, and the kids
sort of becoming
and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He doesn't want kids, and then he's sort of...
I mean, it's his character arc.
Exactly, yeah. Ninja Turtles, we have this with Splinter, the idea of, you know, the turtles becoming a family, the Foot Clan is, you know, sort of the antithesis of a family. You know, there's even Splinter has that whole great thing with the kid about how all fathers love their sons.
Yeah.
Hellboy 2, in this one... Liz is pregnant, and Hellboy is like dealing with the thought that he might, you know, might become a father. It's very like early in the process of him sort of having to mature as a character and learn some responsibility, and learn how to deal with like an actual relationship, with Liz. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. This is the one that sort of has the most of Harry's dad's backstory, and
yep.
Sirius Black kind of becomes a surrogate father figure.
Godfather.
Return of the Jedi, obviously, with Darth Vader. And
spoiler
so here's
alert.
The thing. God damn it. Here's the thing. It was between this and Empire. And
yeah, both deal heavily in it. I think maybe more iconically Empire.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Empire doesn't really deal with it until the very end. It's this, you know, reveal. Whereas I think Return of the Jedi, Luke has accepted the fact that Darth Vader's his father, and it's all about him trying to connect with his father.
Right.
And Darth Vader's trying to connect with Luke. And that's sort of the whole arc of that movie. Whereas I don't think it's as prominent in Empire. Plus, I just don't know if Empire would be as good in a rep like this because it ends on such a cliffhanger. And
right.
Return of the Jedi is you know, as flawed as it might be, it does have an actual ending. Then we go to the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Obviously, again, really heavy with the father issues, with Ego, the living planet, being Star-Lord's dad, and all the shit that comes with that. Also, I thought, you know, that's a fun transition to go from, like, sort of old space adventure to new space adventure.
Yeah, yeah.
And then finally, again, rounding out with another Spielberg, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade. It's the one where we meet Indiana Jones' father.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Very clever. I really thought you were just like picking movies you liked.
Like, I mean, I was picking movies I liked.
No, I know
it. But I was actively trying to think of some kind of a theme to tie them together, since the point, sort of the thought experiment to me was like, okay, you know, try to make a connection between these movies that seemingly have none.
Cool. Well, mine has maybe a slightly looser theme than that, but and I put a few more rules on mine that's okay. Not in the original prompt. I never picked a part one of anything.
Interesting.
And I try not to have anything that is either too new or too common, I guess. Like, you know, for the most part, all the movies on your list, you could perceivably see in a theater anytime. Not anytime, but, you know, not difficult. Either you've just seen it in a theater within the last 2 years or so, or it's most definitely going to be playing at a Fathom event or something in the next, you know, year or two.
Yeah.
So everything here, I tried to show stuff that might not show unless given a chance like this. With a few exceptions.
Yeah, that's fair.
With a few exceptions. Okay, so we start the night off with Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift. This is the third in the series, which is originally supposed to be kind of a one-off. It's sort of tangential, has nothing to do with the first two movies, and then later on they kind of weave it into canon. But this was kind of seen as like a WTF at the time, but really sort of changed. This is when they brought on Justin Lin as a director, and his approach to action directing is a lot more sort of stylish and Mountain Dew infused. My second movie of the night, Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, The Metal Years, which is my favorite of the three. I think it's...
This is a documentary.
Documentary, right? By Penelope Spheris, who would later go on to do Wayne's World and a bunch of comedies in the 90s. But in the she started out as a documentarian, and she did these L.A., rock docs, Western Civilization Part 1 in the early 80s, kind of covering like the early punk scene in LA, Black Flag and the Circle Jerks and Fear and all those bands. Part 2 came out in 87, and it covered the Sunset Strip hair metal scene. And it kind of became like this cult movie. I mean, all three are sort of cult movies, but this one specifically within sort of the like rock metal community, because it's like a perfect snapshot of that time, and it's super campy, but also like from a director who's clearly not, you know, like she's into it. She's like a fan of this music, but she's also like a female director. And this will all come up when we talk about The Dirt, I'm sure. But she's a female director who's like a fly on the wall for like this insanely machismo, misogynistic world. And it's fascinating. I could watch that documentary 100 times. I'm not even into that kind of music really, but, compared to the other two docs that are about music I care for a lot more, I think that one is the most interesting of the three. Star Trek, The Journey Home, AKA the one with the whales.
oh shit. I was thinking it was the newer one for some reason.
Oh, like even though you... Star Trek Beyond or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No. The one with
The one with the whales.
I just think I like that one a lot because it's sort of like, you know, I'm kind of giving away my thing, I guess, but it's sort of like a little genre-wise different than all the other ones, right? It's kind of a break from what they're doing normally in the series. And again, I think it was maybe the first Star Trek movie I saw all the way through. I might have seen Generations before that, I forget, but that was definitely the first one I rented.
It's a weird one to start with.
It is, but then when I went back and watched them all again, when I bought them on Blu-ray, it stood out to me. Same with the third Planet of the Apes. They both came out No, they.
Yeah, that's a weird one.
There's a decent amount of time between them, actually, but they're both kind of similar concepts where they go to present day and
are talking to normal people. Totally.
Yeah, and that could have very easily been on this list too, but it's not.
I actually almost chose Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan because there's all the stuff between Kirk and his son.
Very true. But, very true.
It just didn't make the list.
All right.
Anyway.
So number four on the list. Now we're kind of getting a little later into the night. Things are getting a little loopier. Might be starting to get a little tired. So we hit you with Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. It's only two of them. Okay. Valley of the Dolls and then Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. Both campy cult classics from the 60s. Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, more of a spiritual sequel, I suppose, sort of like Tokyo Drift in that sense, where it doesn't really have anything to do story-wise with the first one. It's just sort of a similar concept. But that was the one that was directed by Russ Meyer, the exploitation guy who did Faster, Pussycat, Kill Kill. And it was written by a young Roger Ebert. And it is batshit crazy and so much cocaine that was happening on that set. and I highly recommend anyone go see that. Later in the night, kind of a dark one. Back to the Future 2. I don't know. I don't have that much to say about that one, other than it is the darkest one of the three.
I think I'm feeling from you that maybe part three would fit a little better.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Then we're kind of closing up the night now. You're really tired. You're really going to need something with a lot of energy to kind of, you know, not doze on this one. Step Up 3D.
Okay.
Step Up 3D, the best of the Step Up movies. And you don't have to really follow any kind of story. So if it's, you know, 6 in the morning or 5 in the morning or something like that, you can just kind of enjoy the dance sequences, the music. You're going to feel like you're sort of high on something anyway at that point. You can just sort of enjoy it as a purely cinematic experience. And then we end the night with Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
All right. Cool.
That's my franchise marathon.
What is your theme? Like,
I guess my theme is sort of the ugly ducklings of their series.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I see that, except for Back to the Future Part 2. I think if we're saying that, Part 3 would fit better because that's the one that generally...
It's the least like the other two.
And generally, I think it was the least liked. I think a lot of people weren't as into it.
I think that's the case now. But when I was a kid and talking...
No, but Back you were a future, kid. But you were a kid. You were like, ooh, cowboys.
No.
I remember it.
What I'm saying is that when I was, you know, when I would hang out with friends and stuff like that, you know, up till, I would say, fairly recently, like in the last maybe 5-6 years, and then especially in the last, like, 2 years for obvious reasons, I always thought that Back to the Future 2 was the overlooked one. Like, people would talk about, like, Mr. Fusion and things like that, but generally people would always have higher regard for Part 3. Like, they would, that was always one of my least favorite ones. Like, it's definitely the one I've seen.
Are you high on cocaine? I've never heard anybody say they regard Part 3
more than Part 2.
No. In fact,
it seemed that way to me because Part 2 is the fussier one. It's dark. There's a ton of, like, timeline stuff going on. It's the most kind of sci-fi of the bunch.
Yeah, but I think that's why it's sort of loved. I don't know.
I think in the 90s, when people were more into, like, Tombstone and into, you know, like, Indiana Jones ripoff movies and that kind of stuff, I think Part 3 was more sort of the zeitgeist. And now people are more kind of into 2 retrospectively.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I remember it seemed like people weren't as hot on it at the time. Maybe that's just like a weird sort of Mandela effect thing for me.
Yeah.
But we
need feedback on this for sure. Which do you prefer, audience? Back to the Future 2 or 3? I might have to put a Twitter poll or something.
Yeah, I think so, because As far as I remember, I think it, I remember the
part
transition.
One is the best, but
see, I think I prefer part two. I always liked it because it's the most sci-fi, because it's weird. And I just remember when the third one came out, it was like, okay, cowboys. Like, they went
that was
from
always
sort
my
of
take.
This. They went from sort of the sophisticated, like, hard sci-fi to, okay, now it's cowboys. I don't know. Maybe it was sort of an overreaction to the perception of part two.
I don't know. You know, when I was a kid, like, going to, like, people's houses or whatever, and they wanted to watch a Back to the Future movie, it was always like, oh, let's watch part three. That one's my, or like when kids talk about it in the playground and stuff, like that always was like the one. And I was like, really? I'm not so into that one.
We're definitely going to need some listeners to get involved to settle this, because I think that part two is way more highly regarded than part three.
Could
but
be a regional thing too. Who knows?
Yeah, that is entirely possible.
All right. Now let's get to what we're really here to do. And we're going to talk about Hellboy, the new movie from the weekend. And go ahead and set that up, Keith. What is happening in the... do we call it a remake, a reboot, a reimagining?
Yeah. So the new Hellboy, sort of a soft reboot.
Hellboy 2019.
Yeah. If you've seen any of the other Hellboys or read any of the comics, you already kind of know this. If not... Hellboy is he was a demon from hell summoned by the Nazis. And that summoning was interrupted by the Allied forces. Professor Trevor Broom finds him and raises him as his own son. He grows up and becomes an agent for the BPRD and fights supernatural crime. That's sort of the backstory of the character. This particular adventure, Hellboy he's been with the BPRD for a while. He's kind of a little jaded about their sort of procedure and their way of sort of shooting first and asking questions later when it comes to monsters and spiritual entities. So he's getting kind of tired of his position with the BPRD. In the meantime, there is this pig monster, the Grimach, who's going around finding these severed body parts for Nimue, the Blood Queen, this witch who was killed by King Arthur in the, you know, 17th century or some shit.
Middle Ages.
She's been cut to pieces and split, and those pieces have been hid across the globe at various religious sites.
And if her body's ever put back together, then she's going to come back, fulfill some demonic prophecy, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah. And blah, blah, blah.
Keith has opinions about this movie.
Yes, I do.
I saw it last night.
I was pretty bummed out by this movie. I'm a fan of Hellboy. I'm a fan of the comics. I'm a fan of the Guillermo del Toro movies. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of the character.
Yeah, I mean, you're like a true fan. Like, you have all of the omnibuses.
Fuck that. I have the fucking library editions with gorgeous oversized print.
Yep. Has original art and that kind of stuff. You've delved deeper into like the BPRD series. So like there was a ton of times watching this movie where it's like, I don't know what's happening, but I bet Keith does.
Hellboy's one of my favorite comic book characters of all time. Like, right. He's right up there with Batman and Spider-Man for me.
Right.
He's just so interesting, and I love that the stories have this root in folklore. I think this movie meant well, but they're really throwing, like, decades of story into this without any real sort of emotional build or connection between these sort of tangential stories. And it to me, it felt like a great big mishmash. And on top of all that, it's kind of an ugly, gross movie. If you didn't know, it's rated R. The movie will not let you forget that.
Oh, the marketing won't either.
No, and now that I've seen a rated R Hellboy, I go back to my original position that it doesn't need to be rated R. It felt weird. Like some of the violence and stuff, mm-hmm. I think worked, but some of it was so unnecessarily gory and but it's not even the violence that I had a problem with. It was like the weird swearing. Like the movie opens with Trevor Professor Broom being like, "There were fucking witches," and I'm just like,
Played by Ian McShane, still like doing his pirate impression off of the last Pirates of the Caribbean movie he was in.
And I don't know if it was his performance or if it was just his interpretation of the character that I fucking hated him in this movie.
Yeah, it's pretty annoying.
He was like trying to be trying to interpret the character as this like abusive, like emotionally distant father, but
like hard-nosed, honestly, if like military father,
if you want to see an example of a character like this, but it actually works, watch the Umbrella Academy. There's a very similar character who sort of raises these, you know, mysterious super kids. And there's definitely an emotional distance, but it's not like cartoonishly abusive. So this movie, it jumps all over the place. It's trying to sort of give you an everything in the kitchen sink approach to Hellboy. And I think that that was the wrong approach. I think there's too much. There were elements I liked. Uh-huh. There were parts of the story I actually liked. Like there's this, the scene sort of opens with this set piece in Tijuana that I thought was pretty fun. I did enjoy seeing Lobster Johnson on screen because he's one of those characters that you're like, there's no fucking way that they would ever put him in a movie. But it doesn't do anything for the story. There's no reason.
No, it's just, other than, it's just a cameo. Like, just like, hey, I'm in the movie now.
And you're like, it's such a weird cameo for a character that, like, it's not going to do anything for anybody but people like me. I don't know.
It's called fan service.
Yeah, and I felt like some of the movie was trying to do that while also just there was just too much thrown in. Like the Wild Hunt is a whole fucking arc in the books that again it has some sort of connection to a broader story. In this it doesn't really. Like he just sort of goes on this adventure and gets, you know, and then has to fight some guys, and then has to fight some trolls who killed the guys. Like,
yeah,
they're just sort of a mishmash of.
It's pretty much just a series of Hellboy going from one location to another to fight different monsters.
Which I think that the better movie to do that, because I think so. There is sort of a tradition with Hellboy of telling these sort of shorter stories, these sort of short little monster stories. I think something that would have been a cool and probably a much more interesting approach, but I know there's no way in a thousand years they ever would have done this, but do like a series of vignettes. Just do a bunch of Hellboy short stories, and you know you can tie them together with sort of a framing device. I think that would have been cool, and you could have done it without trying to tie them all together in this epic
overarching
thread that's just sort of rushes this. It just was a mess. I just didn't really enjoy it. It doesn't have what the Guillermo del Toro movies have, and that's heart.
No, Nope.
Ron Perlman and Guillermo del Toro had such reverence for the character, and I'm not saying that what's his name was necessarily terrible. David Harbour. I think he wasn't actually terrible as Hellboy. I don't want it to be like, oh, only Ron Perlman can do it. I think he was fine.
Although sometimes when he gets a little screamier, he sounds like Chris Farley doing Matt Foley.
I think part of that was his mask. Like, there were times when I think the makeup looked better than others, and there were times when it sort of sounded a little masky to me.
Well, and there's probably some ADR and some whatever going on as well, but every once in a while he would get into Lottie freaking Daw kind of territory.
I wasn't totally bothered by that.
I'm not saying that as necessarily a diss. I'm just like, oh, it's kind of a Matt Foley sort of voice right now. I think I'm just sort of kind of used to the Perlman take. But I actually enjoy, I thought he was taking the project like vastly more seriously than everybody else in the movie.
Yes. Yeah.
don't think he knew what movie he was in exactly.
I don't think this movie knew what movie it was in. Like, I feel like it was trying so hard to sort of go for this R-rated sort of Deadpool appeal, but Hellboy's just not that kind of character. Like, it just didn't quite fit. Like, I didn't think that the R humor worked. And ultimately, I think it's just that the story doesn't really make any sense. It's just sort of a mishmash.
No, it's just a bunch of stuff. I mean, it's a bunch of meeting people. And here's the thing. Remember, there's a few times recently we've reviewed movies and you said you kind of went on a journey with it. Mm-hmm. For me, this was a journey movie. And first of all, let me just put it out there. This is not a good movie.
Like, no.
It's pretty indefensible.
This is sort of the definition of schlock.
Yes. So whatever I say that might sound positive, at the end of the day, you know, if it's a thumbs up or thumbs down sort of way of looking at it, it's a thumbs down. Here's the thing. I went into the movie, didn't really have that much expectations for it. Didn't really want to go, to be totally honest, because I wasn't really happy with the trailers. And, you know, I like the Guillermo del Toro ones enough. I think we've had Hellboy. But I do like Neil Marshall, generally, as a director. Not all the time, but he's made some very good movies. The Descent, even Doomsday, which I think genealogically has the most in common with this movie.
Yeah.
I think is a fun kind of exploitation romp. You could tell that the directive of this movie, when they went into it, was like, listen, we can't be Guillermo del Toro. Like, it's impossible to try and replicate his vision. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, the costume looks similar, and, like, certainly, like, there's certain scenes or whatever that are going to align with those, and you can't help by, if you're doing Hellboy, things are going to look Hellboy-ish. But
yeah.
But basically, I think the directive of Neil Marshall and the screenwriters and everybody involved was, our take is going to be the rude, rowdy, raunchy Hellboy. And it's going to be kind of low grade and dirty, and we're just not going to give a fuck.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the tone. And I think because of that, it's kind of insufferable for most of it.
Yeah.
There's this kind of like juvenile 14-year-old sense of humor to it that almost never works. Now, every once in a while, certain people's line delivery is a little better than others. I'm right with you. I think Ian McShane is just like off the walls bad in this movie. Miscast and also just like a ridiculous take on this character. I mean, you go from, like, Guillermo del Toro's, like, kindly old Geppetto, like, oh, Hellboy, we're going to be doing this, to Ian McShane's like, you piece of shit demon, this is what you're going to be doing.
and he even, like, phones that in, too. Yeah. He's like, eh, you're a piece of shit. Just get over it, you bitch and fight a monster.
Right.
I didn't know they were going to try to kill you. Like, yeah. Come on.
And scenes, scenes just kind of happen for no reason. And first half of this movie, I was pretty much hating it. Like, rolling my eyes every 5 minutes at the ridiculously bad dialogue. And really shoddy CGI a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And I think this might have been shot for 3D. I don't know. I saw it in 2D, but there's certain, like, ways of, like, you know, them throwing things at the camera and stuff that I'm like, oh, this is probably supposed to be a 3D effect that I'm not getting. Which always, whenever you see 3D and 2D, everything looks a little more fake.
Maybe that was it.
That might have been the case. I don't know if they'd ever got retrofitted or not. So
I just sort of chalked it up to bad CGI.
It's not good. It's not up to par for certain. Then we get to the middle point of the movie where we meet, I should have my apps open. Who is the girl?
Alice Monahan, played by Sasha Lane, right?
Yes.
The psychic girl?
The psychic girl, yes. We meet her, and then we also meet...
Major Ben Daimio, played by Daniel Dae Kim.
Yes. We meet them, and then I think a movie starts to kind of coalesce. Whereas before, it was just a bunch of random CGI nonsense and gore battles and whatever.
See, this was when I started to hate the movie. But anyway, continue.
Okay. We might be on two different types of things then. I think that those three and sort of the dynamic that plays between them, they kind of settle into a groove better than when it was just Hellboy kind of randomly being slingshotted from one thing to another. And the movie's still kind of like that even after that point, but at least there's kind of a core unit. And I feel that there's the characters, the movie starts to like the characters or at least somewhat care about them a little bit more after that point. You have the semblance of character arcs every once in a while. And then I kind of turned my brain off and resigned myself to the fact that this is a terrible movie, but maybe intentionally so. And I'm going to enjoy this movie at its level, which is schlock. This is just random gore ridiculousness. And
yeah,
at that level, if you have no particular attachment to the character, and the movie is so batshit and so over the top at times, and is so just doing whatever it wants to do. And then you have at that core some halfway entertaining characters to be around that I think you have an experience here that is, while not a quality film, kind of fun.
Sure. I mean, it's campy as fuck.
And Mila Jovovich, who plays the witch, she's pretty much just doing like a Kmart version of Cate Blanchett's character from Thor Ragnarok. But
yeah,
she knows what movie this is because she's already done 7 or 8 of these with her husband.
Well, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. She's been here before and she is so comfortable in this world.
Here's the thing. I understand all of what you're saying and I do agree with you. My problem is that it's schlock attached to a character that already has 2 real good movies. And that are more fun in every aspect. They're more funny. They're
more creative, more artistically sound, better production design, better monster design, better special effects. And these movies are like over 10 years old now.
And better character development, like, you know, between Hellboy and Abe Sapien. I mean, yeah, maybe not every character is super well-rounded, but between Hellboy and Abe Sapien, like, you have a pretty fun dynamic. And Liz, even though she's very different than her comic version, I like the Liz in the movies. She's not as strong I mean, she, if you're comparing it to the comics, there's like no comparison, but
no,
you know, but to me, the first two Hellboy movies are sort of like the X-Menification of Hellboy. And for that, it works and they're really good movies. And this is just like, it's just a, it's sort of a dumbed down, schlocky, gory version of what Hellboy should be. And so for me, it was really disappointing. I did have some fun with some moments. Like I said, I did kind of like the vampire wrestling. I actually liked sort of the just Hellboy meets a monster and fights it aspect more. It felt like the whole world ending stuff was really forced and like trying to force sort of this end.
Really tropey, Hellboy's really boring. Yeah. I mean, if you're just following the, you know, the three act structure of the plot, like how the villain and her deal or whatever, none of that's particularly interesting. It's just there. It's a framework to hang set pieces on. There's one that I think actually stands up to.
Is that the part with Baba Yaga?
Yes.
That sequence whole sequence is
like,
cool.
It's like they like went to Del Toro's team and had them make that for them. And then they just put it in their movie. Because that's almost up to that level. It's like it's using special effects in a good way. I think it's more practical, really fun, detailed environment, really creepy. And that's kind of when I was sort of like, okay, movie, like you got some cards up your sleeve. Like I'm at this point, I'm not falling asleep anymore. At least I'm now like engaged, even if I'm not always sort of engaged in a positive way. But I think I have a soft spot for movies that are so off the rails that you can't even judge them in the terms of like what movies do anymore.
I guess.
And I think this movie hits those kind of delirious missteps every once in a while that are like unintentionally interesting.
Yeah. No, here's my problem is I feel like there was probably a better version of this movie at some point. You know, maybe in sort of script development.
Something bad happened, for sure.
That could have maybe actually held up on its own.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole movie sort of feels like Ian McShane to me. Other than a few bright spots,
mm-hmm.
It's just don't see it. Just go watch the originals.
Yes, for certain. It's night and day. I mean, given that it's the same subject matter, it's you know, those movies are like Chinatown compared to this. But I think there's a certain kind of Cheeto beard basement dwelling horror geek who's gonna get something out of this.
Okay.
And I kind of rep for the Cheeto Beard basement dwellers sometimes. I think that there's kind of a world of paracinema that exists and is still talked about to this day just because of those type of people who like tape trade and like, you know, talk about, oh, dude, I got the, you know, a copy of the guinea pig series and the, you know, like those kind of people. And I think those kind of people are going to kind of have some affinity for this movie. It's not good. But I don't think it's always uninteresting.
All right.
So
many better ways to consume this character.
Watch it on cable. That's what I say. Well, I mean, nowadays it probably end up on Netflix or some streaming service. And I think that's the way to watch it. And don't watch it at all with the intentions of seeing a good movie, because you're not going to get that. But
no,
if it's on also, in the background at your Halloween party or something like that, or you,
I can't.
If you're the type of person who likes to get really drunk or stoned and watch a movie, you might be able to enjoy it.
Yeah, I can see that. But I would actually say don't watch it on cable because they might edit out some of the really creative gore.
Yeah.
I'll give them that. I mean, but, you know, at least I got that out of a Neil Marshall movie. He didn't disappoint as far as that.
No, he meets his blood quota.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's overall, it's a huge misstep. And I was really hoping, It's very disappointing because I feel like it only needs it to be about 35% better, and then it could have been something.
I agree.
Like, I see what it's trying to do.
And exactly.
It's just like there's five or six things that are keeping it from being that.
Yeah, I agree with that point. And to me, that makes it feel like even more of a failure.
Right.
Especially in lieu of, you know, the third Guillermo del Toro movie. Like,
right, that didn't happen.
Yeah. You know, that's... Well, you know, we'll forever be wondering what if.
Because this movie did flop.
Yeah, well, I think that is going to kind of put a death nail in Hellboy as a cinematic character for a while, at least.
Unfortunately.
But, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, at least there's still the two you can go back to. It honestly just made me want to rewatch Hellboy 2, which in some ways I think I might prefer to the original.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I should go back and rewatch those because I enjoy them. Yeah, okay, really, so there's that. I'm giving it, like, I feel like I need like two grades. Like, it's like probably a D, but if you're watching it with your camp glasses on, I think it's like a C minus.
I give it a D plus, okay, is what I gave it.
All right. Yeah, it's hanging out on
the,
that.
The only plus is because of because David Harbour actually tried to live up to the legacy, and
yeah,
like you said, there's those moments, but for the most part,
it's pretty trashy. Yeah. Okay. Speaking of trashy, we're going to talk about now our Netflix homework, which I assigned to you 1,000 years ago. The Netflix.
Also, did you notice the fun connection?
Oh, yes.
Between these movies?
Oh yes, I did. So we're talking about the Motley Crue biopic, The Dirt, which is based on a tell-all that was written by the band and a journalist who kind of interviewed them all. So the book, I think, each member tells different stories from their perspective or something to that effect. At the end of Hellboy, the most recent Hellboy, we see
a big
fight sequence to Motley Crue's Kickstart My Heart. Yeah.
Which is so tonally off, I think, for Hellboy.
The needle drops in that movie are just like ridiculous all the way through. Yeah.
Oh yeah. They're so bad.
You know, like ham fisted, terrible. On the nose.
Yeah.
Okay, so The Dirt is basically it's just a story of rise and fall story of the band Motley Crue, real band, who LA glam metal band from the 80s. They meet each other sort of at different like points of their careers. Nikki Sixx is a runaway who comes to LA to make it big. And he, you know, puts an ad in the paper. He meets a very young Tommy Lee who lives in Pasadena and is trying to get into the scene. I think he's actually still in high school at this point, 17 years old. They meet a much older Mick Mars, who's been, you know, kicking in the bar band scene for a while. He's trying to find his next thing. And then eventually Tommy Lee brings in his high school friend, Vince Neil, who can get all the girls going to be their lead singer. They come together in 1983. They release a demo and then their first album. And they kind of catch right at that like MTV moment where all of a sudden the visual is as important or more important than the music, and sort of the hair metal explosion happens, specifically after the US Music Festival, which I was surprised this movie didn't really cover all that much, but they probably wanted to talk more about all of the debauchery that the band is super famous for. If you've ever seen their Behind the Music, which is one I've seen more than once, one of the more entertaining Behind the Musics, the hair metal bands are going to give you the most bang for your buck.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a lot of these guys were insane, rowdy, drug.
Well, especially the hair metal scene, there was a tendency, I think, to sort of put, you know, sort of lifestyle and flash over substance. I mean, that was sort of the whole thing. And, you know, it was all about the party. And recording a record was just sort of your way into the party.
To some extent, yeah. And I think there was also kind of a, it was such a competitive scene at the time, because you're talking about, you know, four or five bars or clubs on the Sunset Strip that are platforming these bands, and all of them are just, you know, trying to outdo each other and get noticed faster, get signed quicker. And so it has to be who has the most outrageous outfits, who has the most outrageous, you know, stage shows, and who's most well known for the craziest after parties and that kind of stuff. And that's how a lot of these bands differentiated each other. And so this movie kind of goes over that, and sort of they're coming together and touring and da-da-da-da. And, you know, their different addictions and vices and problems that they run into as a band as they become more and more famous. So, you know, if you're a person of a certain age, you know a lot of this stuff already. So it really comes down to how is it, you know, what is the cinematic interpretation? What did you think of The Dirt?
Honestly, kind of a lot of the stuff you were saying about Hellboy,
sure,
was sort of how I felt about this.
Yeah.
Like, their story doesn't really work as a narrative, because it's mostly, it's not really like a big rise and fall story. It's mostly just like a bunch of rowdy anecdotes of, you know, like, oh, yeah, and this one time when Ozzy snorted the ants, right? You know, like...
Yeah.
I don't know how well it works as a total movie. I will say... the tone of this movie was pretty trashy. Like...
Sure.
Like, I think, you know, it's all about... sort of, the, you know, glorifying that party, the sex and the drugs and the bar fights and, you know, it's very debaucherous. And I think the problem sort of comes when this movie tries to sort of ground it and justify it, because none of what they did was grounded or justifiable.
Yeah.
And so I think that's sort of the problem with this movie, is about halfway through, it kind of tries to take an emotional turn, but it doesn't really work,
because really
none of these characters are sympathetic at all. They're all kind of just the fucking worst.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's a certain level of enjoyment you can get from sort of watching the worst be the worst.
Yeah.
I just wouldn't expect anything deeper than sort of, you know, like, oh, these crazy party stories about getting blowjobs under tables.
There's like, they do that joke like three times. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot. I think most of the acting is pretty good. I do enjoy, I think that the cast is pretty spot on for these, characters. I particularly enjoyed Machine Gun Kelly as
MGK.
Tommy Lee.
MGK, man.
Yeah.
I put in my review, I reviewed this a few weeks ago, he's become my new favorite good bad actor, because like, what was it, Captive State, he had a small part in and kind of like stood out. And it actually took me a little while to realize that this was him, because he had like the wig and stuff.
He was also in Bird Box.
I didn't see Bird Box, but I know that he was in that. And he was, a long time ago, he was in the direct-to-DVD SLC Punk sequel, which I don't recommend at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he played like a friend or something in that movie. That was like his first thing. But this movie in particular, and then, you know, the little bit that I saw in Captive State, he kind of gives me like a young Mark Wahlberg vibes. Like before Mark Wahlberg really...
Yeah, I can
really
see that.
Settled into his style or like had anything like a technique, like he was just kind of going for it and he was just in movies all of a sudden, and like, you know, era Basketball Diaries or Fear or something like that, like all the maybe up to and including Boogie Nights, he kind of has that vibe where he's just excited to be there. And that kind of works for Tommy Lee, because Tommy Lee's like this big, lanky, dorky guy.
Yeah, who is just sort of excited to be there.
Yeah, like he's, you know, I don't know how much of that is intentional or just like, you know, just a
good casting.
Good casting, essentially. But yeah, I kind of had fun with him. I think the actor who plays Vince Neil is pretty spot on.
Yeah, I don't think Ewan Rayon really looked like Mick Mars,
no.
But I just enjoy him so much as an actor.
Yeah, he was by far the best of the four. I mean, as far as just like, you know, having anything like a technique.
He had a big, really good character in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, and I know.
So he's sort of become one of my favorite character actors. When I see him pop up, mm-hmm. I get pretty excited because everything I've seen him in, he at least does something interesting with it. So,
right. And people might remember Douglas Booth as Titus Abraxas from Jupiter Ascending. But he plays Nikki Six in this, and he's kind of the unofficial main character. This movie tries to do this thing that really annoys me, and people, like, movies as a whole need to, like, stop. And that is doing the, like, Goodfellas voiceover narration. And I think that was kind of the approach to this movie. Is it's like to kind of do a Goodfellas or kind of do a Wolf of Wall Street. We're looking into this world of scoundrels. And in that, we're going to, there's sort of a morality play that's supposed to play out. Except for this movie never really gets to that. Because it's not, like, very well written.
It's not interested in that at all.
No, but it tries to look kind of like, stylistically do that, but this movie just is not Scorsese, so it's that's not happening.
I mean, yes, it's not Scorsese, yeah. But I actually enjoy. I liked it because I thought there was sort of a fun, playful aspect with the fact that you were getting it from four narrators,
yeah.
And that they would occasionally contradict each other. So that actually, to me, made it... I don't think they played it out well. I don't think they did it sort of with enough intention other than to sort of have the Scorsese moment. But I was like... I actually didn't mind it. I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of a fun approach. Like,
yeah.
That you have four main characters and you're sort of getting all four stories. And when it fell apart for me was when you would get other people's points of view, like Pete Davidson has a little aside, their manager has a couple of sides.
He's a full-on character. He plays the band manager.
Yes, but I see. To me, it didn't work when it was not one of the four that was sort of taking the piss out of their story.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, when you're talking about when he becomes center of consciousness.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about is specifically the narrator point of view.
Right.
I didn't like it when it was the manager and their Pete Davidson plays the agent who signs them to a record label.
Yeah.
And both of them have a couple of asides where they become the narrator, and to me that's when it breaks because like it's not their story, but.
No, you're right.
That's when you can tell how little intention they have with it, other than the fact that it's a fun storytelling device.
Yeah, you can tell exactly, and that's ultimately my problem with the movie. I mean, I have several problems with the movie, but I think ultimately the problem is that you can tell they just kind of comb through the book for the most juicy stories.
Oh, totally,
I mean, it's. Pretty much if you've seen the behind the music, you get like the real life version of all these told by the band members themselves.
Yeah.
So it kind of just kind of hops from, you know, thing to thing. And it's trying to be a rise and fall thing. It's trying to be a morality story. But like I said, we've said earlier, it doesn't really earn it. There's not really like a breaking point or moment of change. I think you get that the most with Nikki Six when he, like, you know, he goes through his whole, like, heroin overdose and all of that stuff. And maybe a little bit with Vince Neil with his daughter and the car accident and all of that, but...
Well, I mean, the scene with his daughter is... It is sad and it is touching, but
It's actually played really weird in the movie.
Exactly.
Let me see if you felt this way too. But it felt like the placement that they had it in the movie towards the end. It's like during like the sequence and all of these type of rise and fall stories of like when everyone's shit's just going really terribly, and the band's like trying to get back together, but they can't. They have a new lead singer. It's like a weird, awkward thing at the 90s now, and like hair metal's sort of out. They're trying to fit in with the new generation, blah, blah, blah. All the while, it keeps cross-cutting from that to Vince Neil finding out about his daughter having cancer and like trying to like console her in the hospital, and cutting back and forth from them not making it with their new singer to him like bedside with his daughter. Then his daughter dies, like, spoiler, sorry, people know. And then they, like, reunite, and it's almost like the movie is like, yeah, we had to get the daughter out of the way, so the Motley Crue is now back together.
Yeah,
like,
I mean...
That was weird. That whole, like, construction was actually really weird.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was trying to be more like, you know, neither of them are there for each other when they need to be, but it doesn't come across.
Yeah,
that
it came off weird. Yeah.
And that's sort of, I think, the problem with this movie is doesn't really feel like there's any real weight to anything. No. It doesn't really feel like there's any real ramifications because it's just party to party and banging chicks and you know, like, they'll sleep with each other's...
Yeah,
they'll, like, sleep with each other's girlfriends and...
Cash hotel rooms.
And they... But they set it up like these are going to be some, like, juicy, emotional, like, landmines for sort of later in the movie. You feel like there's going to be this blowout kind of thing. But none of it really adds up to anything. No. It all just sort of comes down to, this isn't a party anymore, and that sucks. And it's like, that's not how you tell a compelling character piece. So to me, it just kind of made, you know, Motley Crue seem like exactly like what Motley Crue is. This sort, you know, this party band that was more... more flash than actual substance.
And that's
why... Which is fine.
Yeah, I think that in a weird way, the movie... I'm almost kind of repeating myself with the Hellboy thing. It's not a good movie, but it's appropriate. Yeah. It is...
Well, okay, I don't think that the schlock is appropriate for Hellboy. There's a lot more going on.
No, okay,
there.
I'll give you that. It's but in this sense, you know, it's not intentional... But I feel like the movie is kind of dopey and one note and misogynistic and obvious and, you know, on the nose and inartful. But that's Motley Crue.
Yeah.
That is that band. All of those things exactly the same words you can use to describe that band. They were, you know, pretty much without substance. And it pretty much just was, and I actually say that as someone who thinks Motley Crue, despite all of that, is sort of an interesting band, mostly because of where they came from and like their, you know, being sort of ground zero for the 80s hair metal scene, and like all of the bands that later just sort of copied them. They were like copy of a copy of a copy by the time you get to like Winger and Warrant at the end of the 80s. But Motley Crue actually has like... its roots in, like, you know, the New York Dolls and like 70s punk and that kind of stuff. And so there's just something sort of interesting about them, even though they essentially became this big debaucherous whatever. But yeah, this movie doesn't really care about any of that, but it does, I think, represent them well. I'm pretty sure the band is pretty happy with this movie. It had a lot to do with its being made, and I don't see why they wouldn't approve of it.
Totally. It just glorifies sort of all this whole party thing. I mean, could definitely be viewed as pretty gross because it is.
Yeah.
But if you watch it from kind of like what you were saying with the Hellboy, if you watch it from a certain lens, There, you know, there is some schlock and some entertainment to that. Just don't, you know, like a lot of Netflix movies, don't expect a lot there to be a lot underneath.
No, yeah, that this is very much par for the course for the direct to Netflix thing. It's better than some, it,
honestly,
but it's it, not, if it wasn't, it's not a, like, you know, a super quality film.
Honestly, if it wasn't for all of the gratuitous nudity, I would say this feels like a VH1 original movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, it just, it feels pretty cheap and...
kind of cheesy.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the thing that really separates it from the, as a Netflix, as a direct-to-streaming joint is, you know, there's lots of boobs.
Yeah. There definitely is that. So, you know, if I'm giving that a grade, I think maybe like a C-.
Yeah, I'm going to give this one a D+ as well. there's some interesting stories, but like you said, I think that the stories sort of play a little better mm-hmm. when you have to use your imagination. So yeah, I think
everything you get out of this movie, you get much better just from the behind the music.
I honestly think you probably get it better from their book, too. Like, I sure. think that's going to feel less sort of gross.
More confessional.
So it's fine. If you just want to relive
your
sex, drugs, and rock and roll,
your hair metal days, then this is the one. I think there's movies that kind of capture this scene, this whatever. Specifically, Decline of Western Civilization Part 2. If you liked this movie, you're really going to like Decline of Western Civilization Part 2. Because
that movie actually has
like more subtext and is more interesting.
Also, another movie this movie made me want to watch was Airheads.
Sure, yeah. Which kind of covers sort of the LA strip a little better, too.
Yeah.
That kind of like... kind of bleeds into like 90s slacker culture as well. So, but yes, I know what you're saying.
And let's not forget that it is my turn to assign you a Netflix homework now that we're back on track. My assignment for you is the 70s sci-fi classic Logan's Run.
All right. Well, that is the episode. And if anybody has anything they want to say to us about any of the topics brought up in this episode, you can contact us at our email, mcguffinpod@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at mcguffinpod. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/mcguffinpod. Like us there. You can see all the news stories and episodes when they go up. You can follow me individually at bccassidy on Twitter. You can also read the writing that I do for the Idaho State Journal Weekly at theidahostatejournal.com under their Arts and Entertainment and Movies tab. You can also read my writing that I've done for the MacGuffin over at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. While you're there, check out the other articles and reviews by the MacGuffin staff over there in Seattle. You can find this podcast and subscribe to it via, what are the apps that we're on right now? We are on player.fm, Pocket Cast, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio. Yeah, the two big ones. Yeah, that's all I
got. Also, if you're listening to us on iTunes, make sure you give us a review. A 5-star review helps us.
Yep.
Honestly, anything you listen to us on, if you like the show, give us a review. Help us out.
Yeah. And by review, it doesn't have to be like a 5-paragraph, you know, introduction, body, conclusion sort of situation. You can just be like one sentence, like these dudes are rad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that'd be cool. That'd help us out.
Yeah.
You can check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com. I keep that updated with my upcoming shows, which I do have a show this Friday at Old Town Improv Company at 9 p.m. Alt Comedia. It's an alternative stand-up variety show.
Mm-hmm.
So check that out. That's the 19th, I believe. Also, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook at Keith Foster Kid.
All right. And be sure to check out our other friends out there doing podcasts of their own, including Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, and Mike Falick over there at Hack Thought, and Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places, and Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast.
Beware my claw, for I've come to inflict justice.
You're welcome.
Thank you.